We are back with the Paula Gordon Show. Our guest is Dudley Clendon, and we are at the St. Mark Methodist Church in Atlanta, Georgia. I specifically say that because it is not an obvious place for a gathering of people concerned about the rights of gay and lesbian people. Or maybe it is.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, because there's one big, I guess, opposition to gay rights takes a form that's not true of opposition to every other minority group, or there's a difference of intensity, I guess. And the thing, I guess, that gays and lesbians have such a hard time demonstrating to part of the American culture is they're just as moral as anyone else, you know. You know, one of the, I guess, the hallmark of the Black Civil Rights Movement was that it had such moral dignity. It came out of the churches. It's hard for a movement that came out of the bars to convince people that it has the same sort of moral character, that it has an equal sort of humanity, if you will. A lot of people don't understand they were in the bars, homosexuals were there, because they had nowhere else to go. The churches wouldn't let them. If you identified yourself, you weren't welcome. That being said, there have been a few churches through the time of the movement. Universal Unitarian is one, a Methodist sometimes in important places, American Baptist in important places, sometimes Roman Catholic, who've helped the movement, given it space, given it places to meet, because people had no place to meet, no place to go besides bars where they might be arrested. So some churches have been tremendously helpful, but at the same time, halfway through the movement, when the fundamentalists discovered what they saw as a big threat, they founded their opposition, and still do, on the Bible. I mean, every minority group has had to contend with the same sort of thing, and that almost everyone has been seen as inferior, less moral, less competent, less reliable, less strong, tall, handsome, and American, you know.
But not everybody had Leviticus.
But not everybody had Leviticus, that's it.
Yeah.
And
quote for us why Leviticus matters.
Yeah, okay, I will. Leviticus, that's where that great phrase, abominable and detestable, comes from, basically. And it grew up in Christian doctrine that and that when one man lay with another, it was an abominable and detestable act. And, you know, law, when it began to be written, was based on the Bible. And American law was based on English law.
And it went back to Henry VIII. I didn't know that.
It went back to Henry VIII, to the 16th century. So colonial law was based on English law. When the colonies rebelled, American law became based on colonial law. So that basically by the time of World War II, all sex that was not procreative in this country was illegal. Didn't matter whether you were homosexual or heterosexual. If it wasn't the kind of sex that makes babies, it wasn't legal. And we've come a long way since then. But that's been the legacy that this particular group has had to contend with.
And it was talking about sin.
Yeah, sin. And it's all been based on the church. And so this culture, its whole legal system, was deeply based on religious belief. And separating religion from government, separating governmental law from religion, has been a slow process. This movement, in a way, is part of that. And that's still the struggle that goes on. When you try to repeal sodomy laws, that's the larger thing this is about, part of.
However, an awful lot of this is predicated on a very selective reading of the text.
Yep.
I mean, there are many preachers who were prominent in your movement, who and many who are allies who read the same text and come to radically different conclusions. And there's a line in Faulkner somewhere about, you know, you've taken to proving both sides of this argument with the same text.
Yeah.
And it's that selective reading that seems to be generating a lot of the trouble.
Yeah. I'm not a biblical scholar. I think my general understanding is that the Bible, is in one sense, is perhaps the greatest committee product in publishing history. You know, it was written by perhaps 100 or 1,000 people over 1,000 years, and most of whom didn't speak with each other directly. And you can find much inspiration and many different points of view in it.
And most of them didn't speak the King James Version of English either.
That's right. The only point I'm trying to make is that there's a huge portion, a huge part of this culture, which continues to see homosexual behavior, sexual relations between people of the same gender, as sinful, and they base that in the Bible, and that's a resistance that no other group has to contend with in achieving its rights. That's the hard part for this particular population to overcome.
Well, until you articulated it that way, I really had not thought about this as a separation of church and state kind of an issue, but isn't that some of what you're saying?
I think in a progressive evolutionary way it is, yeah, I really do. I think it clearly is. I feel even self-conscious using this phrase religious right again and again, but Christian right, call it what you will, but one of its basic goals and its existence in the last 20 years has been to return to state policy its religious views, you know, give those views once again the force of law. Now, I think that's a losing position. I think the direction of change is in the other direction, but that's what makes it such a tough fight.
Well, that can take us straight to the political arena itself, which is at the local, the state, and the federal level, if you will. Those have been different fights, but they're all the same fight as well, are they not? Local, state, and national?
They are. This movement started on local levels, and when at different times when it began to seem too hard or to take too long to win at local levels, they moved to the state level, realizing that, you know, you can't win this town by town, city by city. You can pass a law, a state law, and help a lot more people than if you pass 100 village laws. And when that seemed too hard, it moved to the federal level because this is a set of issues, you know, which is national. It's true for a whole national population. And one of the places where this is, I mean, what you can really see this is in Washington because, in Washington, D.C., in the early 1970s, nobody had the vote. I mean,
nobody.
Congress had
nobody.
Taken away the vote. The Southern Congress had taken away the vote, lest black folks be able to vote, you know, and screw up the results for them. And so none of the residents of the district could vote, which meant that when they first got the vote in 1971, really in a meaningful way, everybody could organize, could start from the same point. Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, gays, everyone. And the federal government was also the city government. So the federal government, which had conducted the witch hunt, was also the government that you could protest against, you know. And lots of Democratic and Republican senators and congressmen had gay people on their staff. Democratic and Republican congressmen were gay, and lots of them knew each other outside of the office in the evening, and they began to learn from each other, and it was a really interesting mix of the personal and the political, which the book treats in a chapter called particularly The Pink Invitation, which I think is good reading.
Well, the whole book is good reading, yeah. But tell us about The Pink Invitation.
Okay. When there was a man named Alan Barron, who was one of the famous Barron's Report. He's a famous newsletter writer. He happened to be a completely liberal Jewish Democrat from Iowa, but he had lots of friends, Republican and Democrat, people in the sort of Christian right, as well as Ted Kennedy, Richard Vigory, and others. Associates of Jerry Falwell were friends of his. Lots of journalists were friends. And what a lot of them didn't know was that Alan Barron was also gay, which he was shy about saying. But he had a big party, sent out a pink invitation to a party an inauguration party for Reagan at the time of Reagan's inauguration, and it was a big gay event, Republican and Democrat. And his house became a place where men who and women, but mainly men who were interested in politics first, who had a passion for politics, could meet each other. Some of them were straight, some of them were gay, some of them were Republicans, some of them were Democrats. Some of them went to bed with each other, but mainly they learned from each other and they learned to work in the system together. And there was only one thing that Alan Barron really did directly for the gay cause, and that was to write a letter to help establish the first gay PAC, Political Action Committee. And it needed to raise money in order to give money to politicians to win their votes for the cause. And to get the money, they had to have somebody sign it. And they needed Tennessee Williams. And they sent a handsome young man to see Tennessee, and he got his signature. Free, I should add. But it's a good chapter.
Well, there's a good line of what's it worth to you? And the young man That's says, right. Well, just about anything, but I'd rather not.
Yeah.
This is Dudley Clendenin, and we are talking about the struggle to build a gay rights movement in America, and we're going to come back in just a moment to continue that conversation. Please be with us.